From Florida to New Mexico, Missouri to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Heritage Foundation has published its annual index of U.S. military strength. The results are both surprising and alarming. We learn why from Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation. The race for the Republican presidential nomination now heads to South Carolina, but the party is beginning to unite behind Donald Trump. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. A new law in California has had a dramatic negative impact on independent contractors. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Leah Polakashvili of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And overspending, not a lack of tax revenue, is responsible for Arizona's state budget deficit. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Heritage Foundation's annual index of U.S. military strength finds the U.S. unprepared for multiple major conflicts. Dakota Wood is a senior research fellow in defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. He is here to discuss the report's findings. Dakota, welcome to American Radio Journal. Dakota, the Heritage Foundation has released its annual index of U.S. military strength. I was struck by the opening line in the report, which stated, "As currently postured, the U.S. military is at significant risk of not being able to defend America's vital national interests." Want to talk a bit about the high-level numbers of this report and how serious is this concern over preparedness?
Yeah, it's a scary line, isn't it, that for all the money we spend and all the reputation the U.S. military has, so we're saying it's a great risk, but it really is. And the problem is this is something that's developed over 30 years, so it's largely hidden from the public. You know, our military does what we ask it to do, but the enemies that it's been operating against are minimally capable, like the Taliban, no Air Force, no Navy, whatever. So it's been able to do things, and it gives this perception that it's very capable. But what we do is we look at the historical use of U.S. military power. We look at what was needed, say, during the Cold War against the Soviet Union on a global scale. We look at things today, and it's tragic. We have a military that is half the size that it was in the 1980s, half the size. It's training in many ways at half the level that it did back then. And most of its equipment, this will be startling, most of its equipment is 30 and 40 years old. So the average Air Force fighter, for example, in the U.S. Air Force is 30 years old. It's older than the pilots flying it. So we came to the conclusion that if we had to go to war, all of the military would be needed against one opponent in one area. And there's risk that it would not succeed. I mean, the people are great, but they don't train enough. They have old equipment, and they have half the force needed to actually prevail.
Interesting. The report does do an overall rating of each of the branches, and the overall rating for all the branches combined was weak, which is scary enough. But If you drill down on that, you have Army at marginal strength, Navy at weak strength, the Air Force very weak. And, of course, the Marine Corps at strong.
That's right.
You're a Marine Corps veteran. So we have one of the branches, the Space Force, now marginal. Only one branch rated as strong. What does this have to say about our ability to react in a world where, particularly in the Mideast, we've had the tragic loss of life there just in the last week or so? What does this say about our ability to engage in an area like that?
If you did an emergency rush, you could push combat power to a region. But if you don't have much left in reserve or the force is too small to begin with, you can't sustain operations. You're going to lose things in combat, people and airplanes and ships and all that. And we just don't have the bench to replace those. So the Marine Corps got a strong. It's still too small. It's only a one-war force. But it's very serious about adapting to changes in the combat environment. It has an almost new, completely air arm, and it's really doing some innovative things with unmanned systems. Whereas, let's say in the Air Force, old airplanes we already talked about. Some of its tanker aircraft are 50 and 60 years old. In the Cold War, pilots would fly between 200 and 300 hours a year. Today, the average pilot is less than 130. So it's only flying half as much as they did back in the Cold War. And you just, you know, if you're only flying once, maybe twice a week, you can't keep your skills sharp. So if we had to go do something, time and distance is a big deal. Taiwan is on the other side of the planet, and the nearest naval base is about 1,800 miles away. So if you get into trouble, how quickly can you reprovision, get a replacement ship on site? So this varying of scores has to do with the size of the services, the age of equipment, whether they're focused appropriately or not, and whether they can sustain operations over time.
Let's talk a little bit more about this age of equipment. You've mentioned that a couple of times here, Dakota. What impact is the provisioning of Ukraine in their effort to repel Russian aggression and now a threat in the Mideast? What impact is all that having on our stockpile of materiel?
Yeah, so on the materiel side, especially munitions, we've heard a lot of discussion about missiles and artillery shells. And so we've been using that. And in fact, we've been using our stocks that were built up during the Cold War, you know, through the early 1990s. But then we had 20 years of operations in Afghanistan. We had about 8 years of operations in Iraq from 2003 to 2011. And so we were already consuming that stuff and not replenishing it. And then something like Ukraine shows up. They have limited stores to begin with. They're invaded by Russia, and we've been giving them a lot of stuff so that they can stay in the fight. But again, your production capability is at absolute minimum. Ukrainian artillery units would fire about 6,000 shells or rounds a day. So in 2 days, 12,000 rounds. Total U.S. production of artillery is 14,000 rounds in an entire month. So the Ukrainians would be shooting in 2 or 3 days what we could produce in an entire month. Missiles are still handmade. Stinger missiles that you use to shoot down low-flying aircraft, the U.S. military hadn't bought a Stinger missile in 17 years. So the manufacturers of those components went out of business, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago. They just, you know, if you don't have a customer buying your stuff, you can't stay in business. Every time we shoot a missile off of a destroyer to take down a drone or a missile that the Houthis are firing in Yemen, for example, that's $2 million a missile. So the budgets just haven't kept pace with the consumption of materiel. The rest of the world kind of goes on its merry way, very disruptive, crises pop up. You need to respond to those because American interests are at stake. But our defense budgets haven't matched that usage rate over 20 to 25 years.
Dakota Wood is Senior Research Fellow in Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. Where can folks go on the web if they would like to read the Index of U.S. Military Strength?
The Heritage Foundation is a policy institute. It is completely member and donor-based, so we don't do any contract work with the government. We don't take any foreign funding or anything like that. We've got about 500,000 members, and our policy analysis and recommendations derive from a conservative set of principles. The website is heritage.org, O-R-G, and all of the material we just talked about with the military index is at heritage.org/military. And it's easy to read. You go to the section you want to, you know, look at, and we've got something like 3,200 footnotes that underscore every factoid that we provide the public. And we think we're doing a service with that.
Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation. Dakota, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Scott Parkinson, of course, is at the Club for Growth. He keeps an eye on what's happening on Capitol Hill, also politically around the country. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
We have not really talked about the presidential race now for several weeks. Of course, we've had the Iowa caucuses, and we have had the New Hampshire primary. We're in a bit of a lull here awaiting the South Carolina primary, so it's a good time to just step back and take a look at developments over the last couple of weeks. One of the biggest, we haven't talked yet about the fact that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has decided to suspend his presidential campaign and endorse Donald Trump. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the impact of the DeSantis move on the race.
Number one, I think that him dropping out prior to New Hampshire saved a little bit of face because while he finished second place narrowly in the Iowa caucuses, it wasn't looking good when it came to New Hampshire and South Carolina. And ultimately, he's going to return to Florida as a very, very powerful governor with a strong legislature and really be able to do good things back down there. So I think his endorsement of President Trump is one way that we can begin to unify the party. And we know that there's been a lot of harsh comments about various candidates from social media influencers to the candidates themselves. But when you have somebody drop out and immediately endorse the front runner, it does begin to heal the party. And I think that unity is so important because ultimately a Republican candidate is going to be facing Joe Biden. And those Biden policies have made American lives very, very difficult, from energy to the cost of groceries. And right now it's effectively a two-person race with Nikki Haley and Donald Trump both in the race. And the big question is, how long does she stay in? We've got South Carolina coming up. Will she drop out after South Carolina or maybe even before? We don't know the answer. We know that there's a lot of funding to continue to sort of have a opposition candidate to Donald Trump. But the reality is, in this instance, that the longer Nikki Haley is in, the less that we can spend on unifying the Republican Party. But I do think DeSantis having a big, big voice coming out and endorsing Trump, and then Trump retiring the nickname DeSanctimonious, is really, really important. So unity and leadership right now in the Republican Party are what's necessary to win in 2024.
If you look at the DeSantis campaign and really all the others who ran for president this year, Scott, their failure to really gain traction, is that a function of the fact that Donald Trump really is running for re-election almost as a de facto incumbent?
That's a great question, Loman. And the reality is, when you have a former president running for the nomination, he has a base of support, what we will describe as a floor, that was higher than anybody else's ceiling. And I think as President Trump faced the numerous indictments, it only strengthened the Make America Great Again coalition and his base of support, the people that felt like the justice system was screwing him over and coming after them. And Donald Trump has very much represented this forgotten, disconnected voter, the people that want to throw out all the career politicians. And I think that that message needs to be heard by not just Nikki Haley or Joe Biden, but all the senators that are running, all the U.S. representatives, governors, folks that think that they're going to take that step from city council to state representative to state senator and so on. The American people want a government that is representative of them and accountable to the people. And too often we have these career politicians that I think are governing like they are not accountable to anyone except for their massive donor base or special interest groups. And you see that, I think, with President Biden, with how far to the left his policies have become. You know, when he was a senator, he was not one of the most liberal senators. That's why you've got all these flip-flops on big, big positions that Trump and others continue to hold and dangle in front of his campaign. But the radical left is trying to change the fabric of America, and I think that begins with Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, AOC, and this brand of progressivism that is ultimately advancing us towards socialism. So we need a big capitalist free market economic system agenda that's going to push back on that. And I also think that we need to remind people that that system has created more wealth and prosperity than any other economic system in the history of the world.
Interestingly, the exit polls from both Iowa and New Hampshire, Scott, showed that the immigration crisis at the nation's southern border was the dominant issue. That, of course, along with the economic climate. And even Senator John Fetterman has been outspoken on needing to do something at the border. So this is rising rapidly as an issue. Do you see this as a particular strength for Donald Trump?
Absolutely. You know, right now there's this big negotiation between James Lankford from Oklahoma with Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden in the White House. And we know that over 300,000 people entered illegally across the southern border just in December alone. And we'll get those January numbers here, I imagine, very, very soon. And if you're not stopping the actual flow, then it's a real problem. There's been reports about the immigration negotiation that they still want to allow 5,000 people in every day before they actually start to enforce our border policies and end the flow of illegal aliens coming across the border. Well, 5,000 people a day equals 1.825 million illegal aliens every year. And that's just an unsustainable rate of illegal activity on the southern border.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to become a member, you can sign up for free at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
The California labor market for independent contractors has crashed in the wake of a new law that changed tax reporting requirements. Eric Bame of Reason Magazine gets details from Leah Polakashvili of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
California's attempt at forcing gig workers to become traditional employees has backfired and driven many of those workers out of their jobs. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Bame with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, Leah Polakashvili, and she is one of the authors of a new report that looks at the effects of AB 5, looks at the effects of this law implemented in California that, as I said, tried to force a lot of independent contractors, a lot of gig workers into more traditional employment relationships, and some of the ugly numbers that have resulted, some of the ugly employment numbers that have resulted from that law. Leah joins us now to talk about it. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Let's start with what AB 5 is, because, outside of California, probably not something many people are familiar with. Give us a brief description of what the law attempted to do.
AB 5 is a law that created a stricter definition of what it means to be an independent contractor under California. And so what that meant is it reduced the opportunities for individuals to be legally classified as independent contractors or self-employed workers in the state of California.
We're seeing this kind of a push at the national level, too. I know it's a little bit different, but the Department of Labor just announced some new rules that are sort of along the same lines here, kind of taking this concept and taking it national, right?
Yeah, that's right. The Department of Labor, January 7th, issued a new rule that, again, more narrowly defines what it means to be an independent contractor under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And it adds these new considerations that significantly limit the circumstances under which a worker can be legally classified, as an independent contractor. And by the way, I should note this rule is far stricter than it was under both the Obama and the Trump administration.
So we've got that, and I think that context really important to the report that you guys did at Mercatus to this study where you found, and some big numbers here, self-employment in California fell by about 10.5%, according to your study, overall employment down by about 4.4%, and in some fields, as much as like 28% of people may have lost their jobs, fields where there's a lot of people who are self-employed or independent contractors, as you were just talking about, Leah. And the study, I guess, doesn't maybe go into this too much, but, this is probably a combination of people just choosing not to take more traditional jobs and also other people just straight up losing their job? Is there any sort of sense of which of those two categories was more significant?
Yeah, that's right. And I should quickly note that self-employment fell by 10.5% on average for the occupations that were not exempt by California's AB 5. And then overall employment also fell by 4.4% on average, again, for those occupations that were not exempt from California's AB 5. Because there were many occupations that got exempt from California's AB 5. Over 100 professions and occupations were exempt by lawmakers, partly because they understood that there might be a potential negative effect of California's AB 5 on workers. And as you mentioned, Eric, again, with occupations that heavily relied on self-employment, so think like farmers or chiropractors, repairers, we saw self-employment fall by almost one-third. So 28%, for example, for some of those individuals. Now, we don't go into the study because of the data limitations, to be exact. We can't test exactly why California AB 5 could have led to this decrease in overall employment, but many different stories and anecdotes from those who lost their jobs could tell us a little bit of what happened. So, for example, it could be that employers have hired some, but not most independent contractors. And it could also be that some employers just stopped working with their contractors based in California altogether. And lastly, and again, this is highlighted a lot by news stories, is that some small business owners were actually forced to shut down because they relied heavily on independent contractors and then could not afford to hire them as employees. And then, and some of them, by the way, stopped working with independent contractors because of fear of compliance. So again, our study can't isolate exactly which one of those reasons it was. These are reasons that were highlighted by different news stories and articles. But what our study does find is that contrary to what the lawmakers wanted in AB5, we don't find that AB5 increased more W-2 employment. And that was the point of the law. They said we want AB5 so that more workers become employees. But our study did not find consistent evidence that AB5 led to more traditional employees. Instead, we found that AB5 is associated with a significant drop in self-employment and overall employment in California.
We're talking with Leah Palagashvili. She's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center and the author of a new report looking at the effects of AB5 on California's labor markets. Leah, not a lot of time left, or just about a minute, but I want to underline that point that you just made there. I mean, the justification for this law, the justification for what the Department of Labor is trying to do now, is to move more employees into traditional, you know, W-2 employment, traditional work relationships where the employer has to provide certain benefits, where all sorts of other regulations apply. So that's the justification for this. And yet what you guys found is that there was actually no increase there. People lost their jobs as independent contractors, but there wasn't any sort of measurable flow into W-2 type work.
Yeah, that's right. We don't find consistent evidence in our study that there was an increase in W-2 employment in California post AB5. And as you mentioned, that was the intent of the rule. And that's also the intent of the Department of Labor's new independent contracting rule. And so based on our study, what we draw from it, the implications is that it's not clear whether the new DOL rule, again, would lead to an increase in traditional employment as intended. And so our study actually suggests that the DOL will face significant limitations in meeting those intended results, and that the rule may have additional negative consequences, such as a decrease in self-employment and a decrease in overall employment as well.
It sounds like one of those classic examples of good intentions backing a government policy and then the results just don't line up. We are unfortunately out of time for today, but fascinating study. Folks, you can check that out online at Mercatus.org. Look for it there. They do lots of other fine work as well, researching into economic issues. Leah, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you, Eric.
And again, that's Leah Palagashvili. She's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. Find her work online at Mercatus.org. Check out our coverage of AB5 in California and everything else going on in and around D.C. this week at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Overspending on programs such as Medicaid is responsible for Arizona's state budget deficit, although the left is blaming the flat tax and school choice. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains why they are wrong on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Arizona continues to be a national leader on pro-family and pro-taxpayer economic policies. In the past few years, state leaders have achieved several groundbreaking policy victories, including creating a flat tax on personal income and substantially reducing personal income tax rates while expanding universal education freedom for all families across the state. Effective in 2023, the state's flat income tax is now the lowest flat tax in America. This is after Arizona once had one of the most progressive tax structures and one of the highest top marginal rates in the nation. Also effective in the fall of 2023, Arizona's Empowerment Scholarship accounts were open to all K-12 students across the state. With massive victories like these, it's no surprise that the Grand Canyon State ranks third for economic outlook in our ALEC Rich States, Poor States report, and fourth best in the ALEC Index of State Education Freedom. Arizona's low overall tax burden and business and worker-friendly economic policy environment have made it an attractive destination for businesses and individuals seeking greater economic freedom and economic opportunity. According to recently released Census Bureau data, Arizona gained over 36,000 Americans on net in 2023 from one of the other 49 states, continuing its streak as one of the fastest growing states in the nation. In addition to economic freedom, Arizona is one of the top states for education freedom. In 2022, Arizona adopted universal education savings accounts. These accounts allow parents to receive some of the public funds that would have been used to send their children to public school and use them for their choice of alternative education, such as online education or private school. Arizona and West Virginia kicked off the 2023 Education Freedom Revolution, where an all-time record 8 states adopted universal education freedom accounts. It comes as a surprise then to hear that Arizona is coming after attack for these policy successes. In an attempt to weaken limited government and free markets in Arizona, critics have wrongly blamed the state's budget deficit forecast on the tax cuts and school choice expansion. Governor Katie Hobbs is seeking to weaken education freedom with her proposals for this year's legislative session. Unfortunately for Governor Hobbs and her allies, the evidence suggests that these policies simply don't add up. A review of available information from the Arizona Empowerment Scholarship accounts show a strong year for the program. Brand new research from the Goldwater Institute finds these ESAs save Arizonans money compared to the costs of enrollment in public school. The average amount parents receive to spend on their child's education is less than the per pupil spending at Arizona public schools. The Joint Legislative Budget Committee points to more enrollment in the ESA program than was anticipated. In other words, critics are attacking this program, which is more popular than the state planned for and is doing a better job meeting the particular needs of students. These budget doomsayers are also going after Arizona's 2.5% flat tax, suggesting it too is contributing to the budget shortfall. The fact of the state remains a strong fiscal position despite the growth in state spending. Last year, Arizona posted a $1.8 billion surplus, and it still holds another $1.5 billion in its rainy day fund. Revenue growth is forecasted to be strong for the next 3 years, no doubt on the back of a strong state economy brought about by enhanced economic competitiveness and education freedom. And of course, Arizona's budget deficit pales into comparison to high-tax states like California, a state I should add that has no broad-based school choice and some of the highest tax rates in America. California lawmakers are grappling with the budget deficit in the tens of billions of dollars, far greater than the deficit Arizona faces. Those demanding a culprit for Arizona's budget deficit should take a closer look at spending growth, including public welfare programs, the biggest category of the state's spending. Baseline Medicaid spending, which has been found to consistently exceed anticipated costs in the states that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare, is projected to increase dramatically in Arizona in fiscal year 2024. The free market critics blame Arizona's monumental free market policy achievements for the budget deficit. The evidence is clear that Arizona and states across the country do not have a shortage of tax revenue. They need to control spending growth. Thankfully, education freedom and tax relief for hardworking taxpayers will continue to be a huge boon for the Grand Canyon State. For more information, you can visit ALEC.org and richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCBC-AM in Manteca, California, WMSG-AM in Oakland, Maryland, along with WRQV-FM in Ridgeway, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.